And today we shall speak about the positive obligations of states as required by the European Court of Human Rights judgment concerning so-called serious human rights violations, as for example abuse of police and of the army, as in Chechen cases. The first question could be, what does it mean, serious human rights violations? And the definition was made also by the European Court in many cases, and the court distinguished between a so-called absolute right and fundamental rights. And you can read in the guidelines of the Committee of Ministers, you have this data, this definition of serious human rights violations. I can cite, if you want, point 3, scope of the guidelines. For the purposes of these guidelines, serious human rights violations concern those acts in respect of which states have an obligation under the Convention and in the light of the court case law to enact criminal law provisions. Such obligations arise in the context of the rights to life, Article 2 of the Convention, the prohibition of torture and inhuman or degrading treatment or punishment, Article 3 of the Convention, the prohibition of forced labor and slavery, Article 4 of the Convention, and with regard to certain aspects of the right to liberty and security, Article 5, Paragraph 1 of the Convention, and, as the Committee of Ministers, of the right to respect for private and family life, Article 8 of the Convention. Then Article 2, 3, 4, 5, Paragraph 1, and Convention, also Article 8 of the Convention, private right. And, of course, all these rights are, not all of these rights are considered as absolute rights. For example, Article 8 doesn't end in the field of the absolute right, but the rest, of course, are considered as absolute rights. And the main purposes of these guidelines was the increased number of increasing cases from different countries of Europe concerning the abuse of police and the impunity of police for serious human rights violations. Not only from the Eastern countries, as one can imagine, but also from France, abuses of police toward immigrants, from Italy, this famous case of Genova summit, killing all up on the demonstrators, Greek cases, etc., etc. And it's a serious problem, this, if you want, right of violence toward the civil population all over the Europe, that because the Committee of Ministers was obliged to react to this phenomenon and issued these guidelines of the Committee of Ministers of the Council of Europe on eradicating impunity for serious human rights violations. It was adopted by the Committee of Ministers on 30 March 2011, and he replaced former guidelines of 12 May 2004, and now all these guidelines are used by the court as supporting documents. And the main purpose of these guidelines is the need to combat impunity. And these guidelines address the problem of impunity in respect of serious human rights violations, and impunity arises where those responsible for acts that amount to serious human rights violations are not brought to account. And these guidelines indicate that when it occurs, impunity is caused or facilitated notably by the lack of diligent reaction of institutions or state agents to serious human rights violations. States are to combat impunity as a matter of justice for the victims, as a deterrent with respect to the future, to future human rights violations, and in order to uphold the rule of law and public trust in the justice system. And of course, in view of the seriousness of this problem, states are invited to provide the possibility of disciplinary proceedings and also criminal and disciplinary measures against state officials who committed or commit these violences. And there are some obligations mentioned by these guidelines. We can speak perhaps more in detail if you will ask me. But what is the most important in these guidelines is the duty to investigate. And from the beginning, the guidelines indicate that this duty has an absolute character, an absolute character. Each time where there are some serious violations, independent of the wish of the victim, the state has an absolute obligation to investigate. And precisely in these guidelines we can read that the fact that the victim wishes not to lodge an official complaint, later withdraws such a complaint or decides to discontinue the proceedings doesn't absolve the authorities from their obligation to carry out an effective investigation. If there are reasons to believe that a serious human rights violations had occurred. You see that the recommendation of the Council of Ministers is rather strong, and the message sent to the government is also, without any doubts, rather strong. And, of course, that means that the authorities must commence an investigation on their own initiative if there is a serious violation of human rights on its territory. Of course, there are different criteria for an effective investigation, as adequacy, thoroughness or comprehensive character of this investigation, partiality and independence, promptness, public scrutiny, etc. And in many cases concerning Russia, Turkey, Poland, Ukraine, France, Greece, the European Court analyzed these criteria of the effectiveness of the investigation, because in many cases the court separates the material and procedural aspects of Article 2 violations from Article 3 violations. Very often we don't find the material violation of Article 2 or 3 because we don't have real evidences beyond reasonable doubt, but it's evident when the investigation is not adequate, is not impartial and independent, of course we find at least the procedural violation of these articles. And it's also very important to underline that the court follows these recommendations of the Council of Committee of Ministers concerning the involvement of victims in the investigation. It's very important that the victim or the parents of victims, for example, the parents of disappeared persons in Turkey or in Chechnya, in Russia, have this possibility to participate in the investigation and the proceedings from the beginning of the investigation. And, of course, arises another problem, the sentences, the punishment. But there is no crime without punishment. And of course these guidelines also indicate that the sentences which are handed out should be effective, proportionate and appropriate to the offense committed. Not too hard offenses, but sentences, but very often they see, for example, in Turkish and, or in Russian cases when the policeman is reprimanded, or he pay an enormous fine of 50 euros to the victim, etc., etc. The government tried to convince the court that the punishment is assured. And of course, it's also necessary to underline the necessity of the international cooperation, and in the Öcalan case versus Turkey, Ocalan invoked some acts of Russian, Greek, Kenyan, and other governments when involved in his capture. And the reply of the court was it was necessary for the international cooperation in the struggle against the terrorists and so-called terrorists. Well, and that's because, keeping in mind these guidelines, it's very tentative to apply them to concrete cases. And of course, my task is to give you a general review of these problems, and especially concerning the Russian Federation, is the main topic of our seminar. And also, I would like to advise you to read this very interesting document cited in the second position, Prevent Arbitrariness and Abuses by Police, Measures Required by the Judgment of the European Court of Human Rights Concerning the Russian Federation. It was issued in October 2010, and concerns especially Russia, not in general as the guidelines of the Committee of Ministers, but especially Russia. Yes, I repeat once more, Prevent Arbitrariness and Abuse by Police, measures required by the Judgment of the European Court concerning the Russian Federation. And even in the introductory part concerning background and the key issues of this problem, the Committee of Ministers reminds that the European Court of Human Rights has found numerous serious violations of the European Convention on account of arbitrariness and abuses by police, such as torture and ill treatment, and the lack of effective investigation into the abuses. And it continues, those judgments which concern various Russian regions revealed structural problems to be addressed as a matter of priority, etc. That's also the message is clear. We deal with a structural problem. And I can inform you that recently the court communicated to the Russian Federation some cases in which, concerning the impunity, lack of effective investigation, concerning ill treatment by police, and with supplementary questions concerning the existence of structural or systemic problems. And now the ball on the side of the field of the government. And that the European Court case law and practice concerning not only Russia but other member states convincingly demonstrate that in order to effectively prevent abuses of police, three major safeguards should be provided. Which are these three safeguards? And the resolution reply them. Any person in hands of police should have immediately the right to inform a third party of his choice about his situation, the first. Secondly, to get access to a lawyer. And thirdly, to have access to a medical doctor. Well, these three conditions and two additional requirements should be explicitly enshrined in the legislation. Any person deprived of his or her liberty must be informed without delay of these three legal safeguards mentioned above, and his or her deprivation of liberty must be immediately recorded by police. Because very often, in many Russian, French, Georgian, Greek cases, we see that the records by police are totally absent or made some days or even months after when the communication arrives to the reforming states, and this kind of records are fabricated. That's also one of the problems of the police, because the secrecy of these acts is unfortunately known by human rights activists and by the court. And of course, this document deals with different Russian cases, but in the light of the new draft law at this moment on the police, because due the mobilization of the public opinion against the abuses of the Russian militia, it was decided by the President Medvedev at that time to propose a new draft law concerning the militia. He was recalled as police, and not only recalling this body as police, but also to reinforce some safeguards for persons and who contact with police, detainees, especially detainees, etc. And of course, this report made by the Department of Judicial Justice of the Supreme Court analyzes this draft law, and especially in the light of the case law of the court, and concludes that the safeguards proposed by this law on police are rather serious, but not sufficient, and propose some elements, supplementary elements concerning, for example, right to access to a lawyer, also, for example, information on rights, custody records, etc. And the court delivered more than perhaps 200 judgments concerning the ill treatment by police in Russian police stations. It's not an absolute record. Absolute record belongs to the Turk, but it's not an excuse for the Russian authorities to say that everything is okay with this issues. And recently, as I mentioned in my first conference, the authorities, when the case are communicated, try to do the best, first of all, to conclude a friendly agreement and compensate the victims themselves, recognizing the violation and paying the awards, the rather high awards, dozens of thousands of euros. And Russian courts also begin this practice. We have some examples of this reaction, especially in Nizhny Novgorod, because in Nizhny Novgorod there is a very important human rights NGO committee against torture, and they are very active in the activities concerning the legal protection and by jurisdictions, local jurisdictions, and recently in one case concerning the beating by a policeman or the former policeman who observed him in the street that his behavior is not conform to the status of policeman, he was violently beaten by this drunk policeman, and the district court in Nizhny Novgorod awarded to the victim 3 million rubles. It's a very high award. Dozens of you can calculate. There are 40 rubles in 1 euro. It's a very high amount. And but for the same, more or less comparative treatment, also qualified by the court as a torture, after our judgment concerning the beating by police of 2 applicants in the Belgrade region, the local tribunal awarded 100,000 rubles only. Yes. And the city of Arkhangelsk, for the beating in police, the local court awarded an enormous sum of 5,000 rubles, 10 euros, 12 euros. And when I spoke in the Congress of Russian Lawyers in February of this year in Moscow, I cited these examples, and the president of the Supreme Court, Mr. Lebedev, his reaction was incredible, incredible. Even for him, it's incredible. You see this difference of practice of, it's perhaps also the topic of Anton, but you see that the reaction is not adequate in all the cases which were under the light of the European Court. That's because the Russian court authorities asked the court, please, let public at least these famous tableaus of awards made by the court in different cases. The court say no, because it's also my position. The court must deliver this internal document to the governments, also to NGOs, etc., to advocates, because they must know more or less the level of compensation. The European Court, after this document of the Committee of Ministers, reconsidered this policy of awards, and changed, increasing, of course, the awards in sometimes by 10 or by 12. And that's because perhaps it will be useful to indicate to national authorities, especially to national court, which can be the more acceptable award. Of course, when I receive a Russian delegation, I tell them in secret more or less the indications, but it's not my task. Not my task to inform them about it, because all the courts must know. But it's another problem. It's another problem. Well, as we see, the court recognized that for Russia it's a structural problem. It must be remedied by more appropriate remedies than the new law on police. Perhaps to reinforce the norms of the penal code concerning abuse of power, etc., and human treatment. And I see that there are relevant proposals concerning this issue, and we shall see in the near future which will be the reaction of the Russian authorities, especially the Minister of Justice, to this issue. Now, the second subject, of course, very linked with the first one, is complaints concerning events in Chechnya, against Chechnya. And as the court adopted about 250 judgments concerning events in Chechnya, and about 300 cases are currently pending. Half of them are communicated, but the problem is that now the problem of so-called Chechen cases goes to the second plan. The first plan disappearance in Dagestan, in Ingushetia, and other Caucasian republics. We see that the problem becomes not Chechenian one, but the Caucasian one. And this subject is rather alarming, not only for the court, but also for the authorities. And about 60% of this application concern enforced disappearances. Other issues include destruction of homes and property, killing and injuries to civilians, indiscriminate use of force, use of landmines, illegal detention, torture, and human conditions of detention, etc. And the most commonly referred to article is the reference to Article 2, 3, 5, 8 of the Convention. There are different kinds of judgment delivered by the court, and the first judgment rendered in 2005 concerning disproportionate use of force during the military campaign in 1999-2000, and Isaiah and others, we shall perhaps analyze this case if we shall have enough time. Yes, also extrajudicial killings of applicants' relatives, Hashim, Ataya, and other cases. Many judgments concerned disappearances of the applicants' relatives and after their unknowledged detention, Bazorkina, Imakayeva, and other cases. The Russian authorities were also found guilty of torture and failed to investigate such complaints, as in the case of Shitaev, Sadikov, and others. And in the absence of domestic findings, what is also relevant, the court often requested from the government copies of investigation files, but the latter's cooperation was rather poor. In some cases, the government delivered us 8 volumes, 9 volumes, if they have something to show to us. But in many occasions, they refer to the article of the criminal court procedure, the famous article 165, that it's a secret investigation, the investigation is not yet terminated, that because the authorities cannot show nothing to the court. Suddenly, they send us 40, 50 pages extracts of the case file, etc. And on some occasions, we decided to, for the pedagogical reasons, to find the violation also of the Article 38, the need to cooperate with the court, the obligation to cooperate with the court. And this secrecy for us was one of the proofs that any effective investigation was made in a concrete case. But they have to show something that they show us. Yes. Then nothing is invented, this legend of the secrecy of the investigation. But not only the Russian government doing it, many other governments do the same thing. And the court, in many occasions, concluded that there are deficiencies in the domestic investigation. And for the first time, in December 2010, the court, in the judgment Abuyeva and others, underlined that he noted that it noted persistent deficiencies in the domestic investigation, in the use of lethal force, and sent a message that it can be for the court one of the cases of the possible systemic nature of these problems. And also some of the cases in which we send this message to the government are pending now before the court, as cases Kaikharov and others, Aslakhanov and others, were also for the first time in the Chechen cases where we asked the government about the existence of the systemic nature of this problem. See, there are two categories of cases, candidates to a new pilot judgment, a rather severe, perhaps, pilot judgment. What's also interesting in this case is that if in the beginning the majority of the applicants were represented by foreign NGOs, which are EHRAC Memorial International Protection Center, Shitin, Russia, Justice Initiative, the Netherlands, etc. But now, more and more, several applications are presented now by individual lawyers from Russia. What is more interesting, from the Chechnya, from Grozny. It's also a very optimistic factor because they are better placed to deal with these cases than due respect to these NGOs situated in Netherlands or in London, etc. For the moment, I can say that half of the cases are represented by foreign lawyers and half of these cases are represented now by domestic and especially Chechen lawyers. Well, if you want, we can analyze the case of Israel. I don't know if you have the text. I'm afraid not. It's not the case, but nevertheless, this case was rather typical, especially in these black series of cases concerning the description use of weapons against the civil population. And the case of Isaiva was one of the first cases who was the object of hearings, public hearings before the court, and the applicant, whose relatives were killed during this bombing, her son and three nieces were killed, was represented by a Russian lawyer, Kirill Karatev, very young but rather strong lawyer, a lawyer of Memorial, a Russian NGO, a Russian NGO based in Moscow, and by an inevitable William Bowling, who also participated in this case as a lawyer practicing in London. And what is important to in this case is the fact that the case provided from the videos of Katir Yur and in the relevant time this village was protected by Russian military forces, but a significant group of Chechen fighters, so-called rebels, ranging from several hundreds to 4,000 persons, entered to the village early in the morning of 4th February 2000, and there was a very severe fight between the federal forces and these fighters. But the population didn't have the time, and the population was not prevented about this danger, of course, and the arrival of the fighters in the village was totally unexpected, and the villagers were not warned in advance of the ensuing fighting or about safe exit routes, and the federal aviation began to bomb the position of these fighters, killing many of them, but also killing some civilians, some dozens of civilians. And the fact occurred, as I mentioned, the 4th February 2000. The date of the opening of the investigation is 16th September of 2000, 7 months after the events. You understand the effectiveness of this investigation made after these events. And of course, it was clear that there were many testimonies that investigators did nothing concerning this investigation. There are interesting legal problems in this case, the exhaustion of domestic remedies. Why? Because the problem is that in some similar cases, the victims or their relatives addressed to the neighboring courts, for example, in the Czech Republic, and received very important awards for the killing of their relatives. But not all the applicants use this way of exhaustion and satisfaction. And the government, of course, made a preliminary objection, asked the court to declare the application inadmissible on the grounds that the applicant had failed to exhaust the domestic remedies available to them. And it was a really important problem, because the Supreme Court, before ordered to view the events in Chechnya, that neighboring regions can deal with Chechen cases because of the situation in the Republic and because of the dissolution of federal courts by the then president of the rebel Chechen Republic, who replaced them by the Sharia courts. Sharia. And that's because the Supreme Court ordered other courts of Krasnodar and Stavropol in Ingushetia and Dagestan to deal with Chechen cases if the inhabitants of Chechnya were addressed. But not all knew about it. Of course, the people living in villages, and they replied that their main argument was that even if it existed, these provisions made by the Supreme Court, they submitted that would be impractical and inefficient to ask only by the civil procedure damages and not to punish the authors of the perpetrators of this violation. That's because they thought that it was incomplete this remedy. That's because the court accepted their position. Even in the beginning, I was not in agreement, but then I decided that, of course, some positive facts are not yet the proof that, in general, the system works rather good. And that's because the court found also the violation of Article 13 of the Convention, lack of effective remedies. As to the substantial violation, what is important, and also from the, not only from practical point of view, but also from the legal point of view, is this statement of the court. The court considers that using this kind of weapons in a populated area, outside wartime and without prior evacuation of the civilians, is impossible to reconcile with the degree of caution expected from a law enforcement body in a democratic society. No martial law or no state of emergency have been declared in Chechnya. Who could prove this exists? Because we know there are some exceptions provided by the Article 2. But what is more interesting from the legal point of view, the continuation of this phrase of the paragraph 191. No derogation has been made under Article 15 of the Convention. Because other states, for example, Great Britain in the cases concerning Northern Ireland, France concerning the events in Caledonia, made this derogation, but not the Russian Federation on the facts concerning the events in Chechnya. Why? Because Russia didn't want to recognize that there is an emergency situation, that there is a war there. They only told about the so-called anti-terrorist operation in the beginning, and then they didn't want to recognize that this operation became a real war. And because Russian authorities didn't make this derogation, that they could become as a result of 250 judgments concerning the Chechnya. The series is not yet ended. Of course, as concerns the procedural obligations, the court also unanimously, as on the first issue, found the violation because the lack of effective investigation was evident. And of course, the court awarded also a rather high awards at that time, 25 euros. Now the awards are more higher. I can say that now the award 60,000 or 70,000 euros by one killed person. If there were 2-3 persons of the family, members of the family killed, respectively, the relatives received even more. And it's also one of the instruments for the court to, if you want, to mobilize the authorities of responding states to be more careful and be more diligent with these issues. Of course, the Chechen problem is under the great light of the committee of ministers of who supervises the execution of the judgment from the court, the adoption not only of the individual but of also of the general measures, and I have a huge collection of resolutions concerning Chechen cases. One of them I started interim resolution of a committee of a resolution of committee of 27th of May 2010. But what is more interesting is the last resolution, interim resolution of the Committee of Ministers of the 2nd December 2011, execution of the judgment of the European Court of Human Rights in 154 cases against the Russian Federation concerning actions of the security forces in the Chechen Republic of the Russian Federation. And here, the tonality is even more serious than in the previous resolutions. Why? Because the Committee of Ministers understood the message sent by the European Court of the Authorities that it concerns a systemic problem. And the Committee of Ministers recalled that when the court rendered the first judgments in this group, the committee has consistently emphasized that the execution of these judgments requires the adoption of comprehensive measures, etc. And despite the efforts made by the investigative committee of the Russian Federation, the Committee of Ministers noting, however, with concern that despite the efforts made by the investigative committee, because the investigative committee created a special group of non-Chechen investigators who comes periodically to Chechnya for 3-6 months, who investigate these facts of disappearances, of torture, etc., and then make an independent investigation. Despite these efforts made by the investigative committee and by other competent authorities, more than 6 years after the first judgments of the court, in the vast majority of cases, it has not yet been possible to achieve conclusive results and to identify and to ensure that accountability of those responsible, even in cases where key elements have been established with sufficient clarity in the course of domestic investigations, including evidence implicating particular servicemen or military units in the events. And references are made, for example, the cases Isaeva, Buyevo, Musaev, Bazorkina, Sesoev, and others. And you see that, of course, the court, the Committee of Ministers concludes that even noting with satisfaction that there are continuous improvements on the institutional, legal and regulatory framework for domestic investigation, the Russian authorities have not yet convinced the Committee of Ministers of the effectiveness of the measures available in the domestic legislation and domestic system, and that because this category of cases remains under the rather severe control of the Committee of Ministers, and that because we can say that the problem of the positive obligation of states, as required by the European Court, now is supported with the energy by the Committee of Ministers, who is not a judicial body, but he is an executive body. That's because we trust on their persistence, and of course the court cooperates with them on this issue. Yeah, you see that the problem is rather important to be short with it, but the time is going on. That's because if you want, I can advise you, I'll give it to Laurie, a rather good article of Philip Leach concerning the Chechen conflict in analysis. Of course, it's a little bit caused by events. It's dated as 2008, yes. But nonetheless, there is a very honest and very good and very complete, to my mind, analysis of this issue. You want to take copies, you can do it.
You can write down the reference, okay?
Yes, yes, you can write down and find it. Huh? Yes, you can see it.
Human Rights Law Review, 2008. Is it
Leach? Oh, a question, please. Talk to my methodology and let it go. Sorry?
Is it Italy okay?
Yes.
Could you have considered international humanitarian law? Could you have determined that there was an existence of an international
law? Not completely, because you see, I'll verify, but I'm not sure, because of course, in post-Israeli cases, we take in account also international humanitarian law. It depends on lawyers. It depends on lawyers of judges, rapporteurs. Now, here we deal with relevant domestic law and practice, and that's all. But in more like cases, we also cite these resolutions of the Committee of Ministers, but not yet the international material. Perhaps in the future, part of judgment will be done, because we reserve this kind of analysis not for all the cases, but exceptionally and usually to the final judgment of Grand Chamber cases. It will be enough, perhaps. I hope so. Well,
yes. I had a question about disappearance cases. As far as I understood, the court almost always presumes that the disappearer died. And I wonder how you reach this conclusion in the absence of a bodily remains.
You see, yes, the court is in a very difficult position, because in some cases there are some indications that the disappeared person was kidnapped by the Chechen fighters and he was observed in the local market, etc. But there is no proof. And if the relatives have no news after his kidnapping, he's presumed to be dead. We are very carefully indicating he's presumably dead. He's presumably dead. Yes. And, of course, we find violation of Article 2 not only in the cases of killing, but also while there was an evident danger of killing. Please, you can read the famous Makaratsis versus Greece case. One the policeman followed a drunk man in his car. They opened fire. He was injured, but not killed. And the majority found the violation of Article 2. Yes, I was dissenting with some judges. But you see, very often, for us, effect of the physical death is not the key element. The problem is that he disappeared, no news about him, and the rest we presume. In some cases, we didn't find a material violation of Article 2. In which cases? One, the relatives gave us a very confused and contradictory version of events. And no testimonies, no supplementary facts were presented to the court, but they found, of course, the violation of the procedural aspect of Article 2.
I think this is general presumption, because, for example, in civil law, overall situation, we have the same presumption.
Yeah, yeah.
If after some time there are no news about this presumption.
Yes. Some more questions? Yes, please.
Well, this is not really a legal question, but maybe also you are also fit to answer.
All questions are permitted.
Okay, but I'm wondering why these disappearances keep going on in Chechnya. What kind of interest do the authorities
have? You know, it's not only the Chechen phenomena. In many cases, the disappearance, the reappearance, is a kind of business, unfortunately. While 60% of the male, young male population is unemployed, yes, all means are good to make money. And they have ancestral traditions of kidnapping. Yes, before it was the kidnapping of future spouse, yes, and it was a kind of ritual, yes. But unfortunately, we had in 2-3 cases the fact that the kidnapped person, Magomedov, perhaps versus Chechnya, but I must verify. I'm not sure. I don't have a computer in my head. But he reappeared some months after, and he explained his disappearance because he was afraid of the vengeance of one of his relatives, that because he left Chechnya without saying nothing to his wife, to his children, etc., and then reappears some months after. But in the majority of cases, of course, the disappearances are dated by these events of the Second Chechen War until 2004. And now the cases of disappearance come from Dagestan and Ingushetia. That the situation is even more serious than in Chechnya.
But and how would you explain this trend? How would you explain this trend?
First of all, of course, not. First of all, there is many complex problems there. First of all, religious struggle between Wahhabis and moderated Islamists. The first one, perhaps, it's rather relevant in the recent Dagestani cases of this year. You can find in the case law that was kidnapped an Islamic activist who organized trips to Mecca. Yes, and he was kidnapped by unknown persons who didn't wear even uniform, as it was in Chechen cases. Perhaps rivals, or we don't know, but we didn't find violation of substantial matter of Article 2, but we found a violation of Article 2 procedural, yes. And in some other cases, there were also a kidnapping of a guy who was a narcotic dealer, and his father wrote a letter to the court that he don't believe that his son was killed by federal soldiers, but because his behavior was bad, and he prevented him many times, he will finish badly because he was a narcotic dealer, because in Islamic country he's one of the crimes, yes, etc. But you see, but there are different, of course, different situations. We can say that it's a unique situation of the soldiers who came by night and kidnapped one guy. He was suspected as a Chechen fighter. Yes. But we have some cases where the applicant's relatives were kidnapped by Chechen police. Chechen police, not federal Russian police, but Chechen police. For what reasons, we don't know. It's the most difficult cases to investigate. Yes. And some of them were stopped on the checkpoint and then disappeared. We have even one case, a captain of Chechen police was called by his superiors to the Ministry of Interior and then disappeared. There is another version that Chechen fighters has spies everywhere, and if they see somebody who enters and then go out from the police station, he denounced our comrades. It's possible also, but there are many versions, and very often authorities speculate on this, but the war is a war, a different situation, and after post-war period also. But for us, what is important, no proofs of the diligence of the investigation, the first thing. Then no proofs that the person is still alive, and we conclude the violation, Article 2. And you see, there are also some discrepancies in the court's practice, and I wrote many dissenting opinions on this issue. When we find a violation of Article 2 in the case of disappearance, we find also a violation of Article 3 because of the suffering of the parents of disappeared persons. Which is logical.
Yeah.
Yes. But when we have we do with cases concerning with killing in front of the parents in the yard of the house, we don't find violation of Article 3. Why? Because according to the very ancient practice, case law of the court concerning Turkish cases, killing is an instantaneous act, and the suffering is less important. It's incredible. It's crazy. And I'm always, I'm both for the violation of Article 3 in this case, but I'm also supported by majority. But the same case law of the court. No, it's not difficult to deal with these issues. Yes. But the problem was, we shall speak about it in the Katyn case. How to deal with it. In Katyn case, the majority inversed the logic and found as exceptionally the violation of Article 3 because of the continued disappearance of Polish prisoners. We shall deal about it tomorrow. Well, another question, please, if you have.
No question.
Okay, that's, you have it, right? You more human and less degrading treatment.